Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Please open your Bibles to Romans 1, verses 14 through 16. Romans 1, 14 through 16. Saul of Tarsus was born for this. He was raised for this. He was prepared for this life. A Hebrew, born of Hebrews, of the tribe of Benjamin, named after the most famous Benjamite who ever lived, King Saul. Born to a family from Tarsus, to a master tent maker, a Roman citizen. Born into a family of Pharisees who were fervent for the law of Moses, and to a family that looked to the city of Jerusalem in much in the same way that Muslims look to Mecca today. He was raised in this family of Pharisees, family that instilled in him this love and appreciation for the law of Moses. Probably around the age of 13, he was sent to the city of Jerusalem. Up until that point, he had probably spent most of his childhood in the local synagogue. During that time, he had probably mastered the Hebrew text of the law of Moses. He had likely mastered Jewish history. He had spent much time in the Psalms and the Proverbs. And then he makes his way to Jerusalem and spends the next 5, 6, 7 years at the feet of Gamaliel, the grandson of Hillel, who was the master, known as the master teacher of the law of Moses. During that time, he learns to dissect the text. He can dissect it layer by layer. He learns to debate in the question and answer style of that day. He's trained and he's prepared for this life of defending the law of Moses. He's prepared to be this part rabbi, part preacher, part lawyer who devotes his time to prosecuting anybody who would go against the sacred law of Moses. So with him being born for that life, I think it's no accident that when we're introduced to Saul of Tarsus, I think it's no accident that they were laying their garments down at his feet. No sentence of death had been passed. In fact, it would have been unlawful for them to put someone to death without Roman approval. But the mob didn't care about that. Young Stephen with the face of an angel, they didn't care about that, and they didn't care about the law because their hatred had overcome all of those things. He was pushed out of the city all the way down to the rock of execution, and Saul watched as those who had brought accusations against him picked up the first stones. He watched as each witness picked up a large, ragged stone and held it above their shoulders and their heads and hurled it down at Stephen. He must have heard Stephen's last words when he said, "Lord, receive my spirit. Lord, please don't hold this sin against them." And it was at that moment that Saul must have seen all of these stones hurled out of hatred, showered down on Stephen. He must have seen the blood gushing from his face. He must have seen his body slip into unconsciousness. He must have seen that dead body mangled and destroyed by those stones. In the weeks and the months that followed, Saul becomes the chief agent, the chief prosecutor, the chief persecutor for all of the Jewish efforts to destroy anybody who would be a follower of the way, anybody who would be a follower of Jesus. And Paul charged at these people with the intensity of an animal charging at its prey. He didn't carry out his orders like a soldier carrying out some unfavorable orders, but he carried them out with all of his heart and with all of his mind. He helped throw people into dungeons. He helped, most likely, to have people stoned. He must have stood and heard the cries of husbands and wives and the curses as they watched their spouse be lashed and tortured. But yet, he stood by and watched approvingly, unmoved by their pain and by their humiliation. He later went to the high priest. The text tells us that he was still breathing threats and murder, and he was asking for extradition papers. He wanted to pursue anybody who had escaped him and fled from Jerusalem. And it's there on the road to Damascus that we read about this change that occurred in Paul. As Jesus spoke to him, and Saul knew that he had committed these horrors out of error. It's there that he realized there's no taking back those actions. There's no getting back those lives that he's taken and approved of taking. He saw the wounds of Jesus' hands. He saw the wounds of his feet. He saw his face, and he knew that Jesus was alive. The very thing that Stephen and others must have proclaimed just before he approved of their deaths. So we look at Romans chapter 1, verses 14 through 16. I believe this background helps us to understand the passion and the emotion that must have been behind the pen or in the voice as Paul pens these words. Sometimes you might hear the preacher refer to this section or to this sermon as the three I ams of Paul. I am a debtor, and I am ready, and I am not ashamed. But I want us to think about briefly about these points tonight, about being born for this, and about how we've been reborn for something as well. But I'd also like to report on a couple of recent mission trips that we've been able to make on behalf of Graymere. Let's think first about Romans 1, verse 14, about where Paul says, I am a debtor, or I am under obligation, both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. Of course, when we read a word like debtor or under obligation, the obvious thing that comes to our mind is owing something, in particular owing money. But that's not what Paul was under obligation. That's not the debt that he owed. He owed a life. He owed a debt of a life. He owed for the lives that he had taken. He owed for the lives that he had approved of taking. Just like us, he owed for the life that was given on the cross for us. Of course, we know texts like, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. The wages of sin is death. We owe a debt because we've been justified by the grace of our Lord and Savior Christ Jesus. Because He paid the price. He became the propitiation for our sins. Romans 3, 24 and 25. Paul owed a life because a life was given for him. He owed a life because so many lives had been taken. Those are the horrors that must have constantly followed him. I think he must have heard those screams as he penned, I'm a debtor to all men. He says he's under obligation to the Greeks and to the barbarians, to the wise and to the foolish. And in saying those words, he's simply expressing that he feels this debt to share the gospel with all men, regardless of the differences in them. Of course, that as Jews, as Hebrews looked at men, they tended to classify men in two ways. You're either a Jew or you're a Gentile. The Romans looked at people and they classified them in two ways. You're either a Greek or a barbarian being anybody who was not a Greek, anybody who spoke of, who was a foreigner or spoke a foreign language. The Greeks would look at people and classify them maybe as a free man or a slave, a male or a female, wise or foolish. So Paul's just saying that he feels this debt because of his past and because of what's been done for him. He feels this debt to all men, regardless of their background. But I think as I read a verse like that, the question that comes to mind is, do we feel the same indebtedness that Paul felt? Perhaps if we don't, then we should spend more time focusing on the price that Jesus paid. If we appreciate the price that Jesus paid, we'll feel that debt. Perhaps if we think about the time that somebody, somewhere along the way, took to teach us the gospel, we'll feel that indebtedness to share the gospel with somebody outside of our immediate family. When I think about being born for something or being a debtor and loving your people, loving all men, one of the people that comes to my mind is Juan and Naya Abanto in Lima, Peru. I love Juan Abanto. They've got three children, Leah and Matias and Kayla. And Juan, I've known him for so long, I've got to be honest and say he's more than a co-worker. He's a brother. He's just somebody that I love. I love him because of what he's gone through. I love him because of the family that he grew up in. I love him because of the struggles that he faced. I love him because of the church that took him in. I love him because of the church that taught him. I love the fact that his love is evangelism. I appreciate that he spent so much time returning to the church that taught him and helping them after he finished in preaching school. I appreciate that he sacrificed, that he and his wife and Leah at the time lived inside of a plywood box, basically, inside of the church building because they didn't have anywhere else to live. And the church couldn't pay them, but they could give them a classroom to live in. I appreciate that he went out each day and looked for carpentry jobs so that he could earn money that way and then work in the church. And I appreciate that Graymere gets to partner with him. When I came in 2010, one of the first things I said was that I really want, if I'm going to come here and work, I want Graymere to work with Juan Abanto. And so we've had that association. We worked with him for 4 years there in the church where he grew up. And the plan was a 5-year plan. The plan was not to stay there, but to go somewhere else and to plant a church. He actually only did 4 of those years because he was so far ahead of the plan that he was able to leave and start a new work after year 4 rather than the full 5. The place that he's working now is called Pachacamac. Believe it or not, this is right on the outskirts of Lima, Peru. Lima being a city of about 9 million people, as big as a New York City, as you know, very developed. But then you got an area like this that's just now being developed, and Juan and his family have moved there to work, and they've got a lot of needs. I felt somewhat ashamed in that Juan's not the type of person that'll share his needs with me. He's one of those special people that he's not going to complain. You know, sometimes we work with folks who are very willing to share needs, but Juan's not one of them. As I was visiting him earlier this month, I knew he'd been living here in this place. They had bought a piece of land and built a very humble house on it. And he said, yeah, we got electricity hooked up last month. And I thought, you've been living here 4 years. So 4 years without electricity. And he said, and we really hope we'll get water soon. See, the way it is in Peru, in most countries, is when an area is developing, the people buy the land, they move little by little, they build up their home, and then they wait for the services to reach them as well. So I was shocked to see him living in that situation. The church is doing well. We need to do more. We need to do much more. When I was there, there were about 20 members that were present, not including the children. There were about four good, strong families that were represented there. But it hit me of how much more we need to do, not only for this good man, but also for the church there. We need to put the same emphasis on that work as we've put in Arizona. And I think we'll see the same results. He's gone there with nothing and produced something. But it's time for us to give him far above and beyond what he's received up to this point and see what he can do with that. At the end of last year, when Juan was here for the CBI, the Columbia Bible Institute, he mentioned that they were being basically forced out of their building. They were meeting in the home of one of the members, but she needed that space for another purpose. And so we scrambled. We got the funds to help them to rent a little church building. But I didn't really have any input in where that church building was at. What I didn't realize until I got there was that it's not much of a church building. In Lima, the poorest people, they'll go to the hills or the mountainsides, the cliffs, and they sort of build their houses just like blocks on top of one another all the way up the hill. But I didn't realize that the church building is there sort of right at the foot or right in the middle of that hill. It's in a place that nobody desires to go. So it really hit me that we need to do so much more for them. He's done something with the very, very little that he's been given. But I feel a huge debt for us to help him and to help this good work. Notice Romans chapter 1, verse 15. Paul continues and says, "So I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome." When we think about eagerness, of course, we think of readiness. We think of preparation as a result of the debt that Christ paid for Paul. Paul's now eager. He's now ready. He's prepared. He wants to pursue lost souls now with the same intensity that Saul of Tarsus had sought to destroy the church. The chief of sinners has become the chief soul winner. I think about a couple weeks ago when Andrew hosted the missions roundtable, he asked us the question about what are some scriptures that you think about that should motivate us to do mission work. And I said Romans 5:8, while we were sinners, Christ died for us. And I said, I think any scripture that helps me to focus on Jesus' mission towards me ought to help me to be eager and to focus on my mission toward others. Paul had that eagerness. I don't believe that eagerness came from his early education. I don't believe it came from that training and experience under the law of Moses. His eagerness, his preparedness, his readiness came from Jesus Christ. It came from the one who had called him. It came from the one who saved him. It came from the one who died for him. It came from the one that he now owed. We ought to have the same eagerness because we now owe the same person. Another trip that we've been able to make this summer, Jeff Loveless and I were able to travel to India in July. And I gotta brag on Jeff. There's so many ways I could brag on him. He's a good travel companion. He can talk baseball nonstop. And I like to talk baseball nonstop. And usually I like statistics and things like that. And usually people think I'm such a nerd because of that. But he knew those statistics and he knew all the things that I was talking about. But even apart from that secular interest, this guy is really, really eager about teaching people the gospel. Preparing for this trip, this was maybe my 11th or 12th trip to India. And at this point, to travel, I just need to pull out a bag the day of or the night before and I can make that trip. But he was eager. Months before, he's saying, what do I need to do? What do I need to pack? What kind of clothes do I need to buy? What do you want me to do while I'm there? And I thought, oh man, this is going to be really great. So we do a lot of preaching and a lot of teaching in India, so I said, you need to have two or three good sermons ready. And I was thinking, this is going to take a little pressure off of me if I'm not the one delivering three or four sermons a day. And so Never a complaint. He said, yeah, I can do that. He said, I've already been working on a couple. So he was eager to accompany on this trip, and I appreciate that. Our first stop, we flew. The trip was so easy this year. British Airways now flies direct from Nashville to London, and then from London straight into India, straight into where we want to be. And so we flew into Hyderabad, which is a very large city. We traveled by a taxi with a preacher named B. Philip Raju, who Graymere supported for a long time, to the city of Kodad to visit with him. You can see from the photo on the screen, it was very interesting to me, John Vaughan's fame. It's worldwide. He didn't even make this trip, but he made the banner. And I thought that was very interesting. I hope one day I get to the point where I can make mission trips without actually making the mission trip. But that was very impressive. They love him over there because he's worked and done so much good for so long. We spent this time in Kodad. It was not an easy city to visit. I like to be in charge of the logistics when I go somewhere. I like to pick the hotel. I like to know there's something edible. There was neither in Kodad. It was a difficult place to spend a few days. But I can say a few good things about B. Philip Raju. He's one that I don't know as well. Graymere supported him long before I came, and we sort of inherited that work, and I'm trying to learn him. But frankly, it was somewhat of a disappointing visit. We couldn't see the church that we wanted to see. There were some aspects that were disappointing in that work. But I did come away with an appreciation for him. He very easily conveyed the thought that he would probably die for us. He would do anything for us to take care of us. And so I definitely appreciate that aspect of our visit with him. From Kodad, after spending a couple of days there, and I want to add also that when I go to India, I like to try to spend a couple of days in one place with one preacher, because in my opinion, you can't do an effective job of checking up on a work if all we do is show up and preach a sermon and all the words and all the communications coming from me to them and then I leave. So I like to spend a couple of days with them, and sometimes, like this trip, we see some things that are discouraging. But I think we ought to spend the time. We ought to take the time in order to gather that kind of feedback and to know the folks we're working with and to know about their progress or lack of. From Kodad, we got on a train, and we had about an 8.5-hour overnight train ride, and I wish I had shared some photos. It was total luck, I promise, that I had a little compartment, and not much of a compartment, but had a little electrical outlet to plug in things and a little curtain to pull. Jeff, unfortunately, his compartment went in, and he had like three other strangers sleeping in there. So, but I promise it was totally by luck that it worked out that way. But we had a long train ride that night. Maybe we slept a couple of hours. Also, every time the train stopped, you'd wake up. Then they'd announce where you're at in another language. So I was constantly waking up and checking the map on my phone to find the little tiny city called Sulurpet, which is where we wanted to get off. So we got there to Sulurpet at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and Dhananjaya, S. Dhananjaya is the name of the preacher who works here. We've spoken a lot about him here at Graymere. His work is fantastic. Of course, he's built a church and also a church building, in fact, but he's built up a church membership. But also one of his main works are the orphanages that you've heard us talk about. And it's just phenomenal, his work. It looks good, and we're so pleased about it. And every time we visit, we want to do more because he's doing so much and always dreaming and planning to do so much more. So he met us at about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and we spent the day with him. We visited the old children's home, which this is a photo of it. Not all of these children are true orphans, but very much children in need. And even though his project the last few years has been to to purchase land and to build buildings and to open up a new orphanage in a new city, he still can't let go of this one because there's still children in need. So he's still providing for these children. However, he's also built this building just in the last year and a half. This building is phenomenal. This is in a new little area called Tada, just outside of Sulerpet. And last year, some brethren from Arkansas had gone over with us, and they, just like we are, they were so impressed by this work. One of those brothers in particular went home, and he's raised up to this point something like $60,000 or $70,000, so that there's been just a continual flow of the resources that they need in order to build this. And it's just fantastic and phenomenal. They've even got an air-conditioned apartment, even with a Western toilet. If you don't know what a non-Western toilet is, you can Google it later. But it's no fun. But they've got even got a room so that if we go, we could stay there in comfort and visit with them. One reason for starting this new orphanage is because they've got to separate the boys and the girls now. They can't have them all sleeping in the same building. The government doesn't like it. He doesn't like it, especially as the kids are getting older. So right across the street, they've also built this building. This is the dormitory for the girls that stay in this home. So we went in, and before they went to school, we had a chance to meet with the kids. Right now, there's about 10 children living in these new homes, and it struck me, a couple of things struck me. You notice the little smaller photo on the right. Each child has one of these metal bins, and it really impacted me that everything they own fits inside that metal bin. I don't think everything we own could fit in anything such a size as that. But it also struck me that each child had a metal bin, but no beds. Again, they've worked and labored so much to build the building, he hasn't been able to afford beds. So the next thing we really need to work on is we got to get at least 10 beds in there. So we're working right now to get that funding to them. About $150 a piece for a bed and the bedding that each child needs. He was not shy about letting me know that he really wants 50 beds. but I told him, let's start with 10. I think we can get 10. And then if you get more children, we'll get more beds. But we're going to start with 10 beds. And if he can get 50 children, I think we should put 50 beds in there as well. But we had an excellent visit with Don and Jaya. His work looks great. We're always thrilled to spend time with him. From there, we got back on the train, made the trip to Chennai. Of course, Chennai, again, it's another big city. About 13 million people live there. You can even find Papa John's and McDonald's, so we're good. We can survive there. The hotels are good. If you're thinking about making a trip to India, you ought to go with us on one of the times where we go, and we spend the majority of the time in Chennai for the graduation, because you're not going to feel like you're really roughing it. But yet, you can be of great service. One of the first things we were able to do there was to visit with the St. Thomas Mount Church. And they were on a Saturday afternoon, they were having a 17th anniversary. I guess they have this every year because 17 is a very odd number to celebrate. But they were celebrating their 17th year of existence. And Peter, there's something to be said about land and buildings, and I know some missionaries are really opposed to building them, but there's something that it legitimizes the group, and Peter Solomon and his son-in-law Emmanuel purchased this land and built this building and worked hard, and to the point that Emmanuel has now left, they now support their own two preachers and are self-led, autonomous, just the way that the church ought to be. So I spent some time with them, so impressed. Their work looks great. I asked them, how is it that you've done this, yet we're seeing so many other churches that 30 years later, they've still got the same 30 members and receiving the same support from the U.S. and no end in sight. And Peter Solomon, he said, I teach self-respect wherever I go. He said, too many people have got the mindset of just letting somebody else pay the bill, let somebody else do everything for them. He said, I teach people to respect themselves and to stand on their own two feet. And then Emmanuel said, I don't know if I totally agree with this or not, but he said, I teach the church that the ministers are going to do the work, and They're going to grow the church. It's your job to take care of the ministers. I think most ministers in the U.S. would say we all do the work, of course. But regardless, they've certainly seen great results with putting the emphasis in those places. We were able to visit the National Bible College on Saturday night and speak there. And Jeff spoke there, just like in the last photo you saw that he spoke at the St. Thomas Mount Church as well. Met two other preachers that had traveled from far away, J. Rao and Single Ryan and their sons. I thought it was very impressive that these guys, we've been working with them for some time, but now they've got grown sons that are also joining in the work with them as well. The next day, you may recognize Jebba Kumar. Sunday morning, we were able to worship with him. Of course, he's come here to visit with us. I think he'll be coming again for CBI later this year. Another wonderful worker. He's sort of the right-hand man of Peter Solomon as well. Another one that whatever work he does, it produces. And he's never associated with one of these works that we go and are discouraged by. But yet, everything he does seems to be in order, and something that we really want to get even more behind. The church, he's in a new location. It's being called the New Chennai because Chennai is growing so much. They're planning to build a second international airport, and that's where he's trying to build this church as well. One of his main things right now is they need land, and they need to build a church building. He was telling me last night, actually, that he's got about $17,000 saved himself, or the church does, that they want to put towards that, but they still need quite a bit more in order to purchase the land. And so we're trying to develop a plan to help them. Because again, as I know a lot of folks are opposed to land and buildings, but it just does something to legitimize the group in terms of attracting the community. Spent some time preaching at the Sinagar Church that houses the National Bible College. As you see there, Peter Solomon and his son-in-law, Emmanuel. They're, of course, major workers there with that church. Notice finally this third I am in Romans 1:16, where Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek." God's got a lot of different powers, but for some reason, this is the one he chose for salvation. For some reason, he chose the foolishness of preaching to save souls. Of course, when we think about shame, we think of humiliation. In our Bible class this morning, we talked about this a little bit. Usually, humiliation or shame is the result of foolish behavior. The older we get, in this culture at least, it seems like we tend to lose a lot of that shame and humiliation over the things that we do. But what causes shame? Generally, I think it's when we're cast in a negative light, or in a light that we don't want to be in. Maybe it's easier to define with kids. The kid that brags about how fast he is, but then gets beat on the playground by the skinny new kid. That brings some shame, humiliation. The kid who always wears the nice clothing and always gets compliments on the clothing, whose parents then file for bankruptcy because everything they'd purchased was on credit. It's easier to define in those ways. Or maybe a lot of times we see guys. I heard a preacher once said he used to pray every day, "Lord, don't let me lose my hair." And sometimes guys, we love that hair, and then as we get older, we realize it recedes every day, it seems like, and thins and falls out. Maybe it's women with skin and wrinkles. Maybe it's the school play and feeling some pride over knowing all the lines, or the football team and knowing all the plays, but then when you get in the spotlight, when you get under the Friday night lights, forgetting the words or forgetting where to line up. Maybe it's easier to define humiliation in some of those ways. But that's not really what Paul's discussing here. Imagine a world where the good news of the gospel brings shame on you. Believe it or not, there's still places like that exist today. Imagine a world that's not like our culture. You know, priests and pastors and preachers, they're in a good light. They're respected, faithful church members. They're trustworthy and they're kind and they're generous. Generally speaking, you're in a good light in our culture if you're a Christian. But imagine a world where it brings shame, where, like Paul said, he talked about beatings and being shipwrecked and being left afloat, being left on islands, being beaten with, being whipped, tortured. Imagine a world where you're surrounded by, where you're outnumbered by unbelievers, and they shame you because of the gospel. That's the world that Paul lived in. He was continually being shamed by those who did not believe in the gospel. But the gospel is also the reason that we should not be ashamed, because God chose that power, that means, that foolishness of preaching as the means for saving souls. The last part of our trip in India was a trip to the Andaman Islands with Peter Solomon. I believe Brother Doug Moss gives a bit of support to help this work. But Graymere as a church doesn't necessarily support this work. We have at one time, the original preacher took a bunch of money and left, and the work has just struggled. It's a difficult place. But Peter Solomon has stuck with it. He sent a preacher named Titus there, being a younger preacher, and he told him, "I want you to find a wife here. Find a wife from the island." And he's not shy to tell you his strategy in that was that would keep him on the island. That would keep him from wanting to leave, because it's a difficult life on these islands. I did not enjoy the trip over there because too much ocean all around, and you look down at all of that and there's nowhere to land. So it was difficult for me even to make this trip. I was a little anxious over it, but everything went fine. And it was interesting coming in. These little islands, these are military outposts for India, and they are not set up for tourists. Jeff and I, when we came through, all the Indians are walking straight on through, no attention, but the little fellas over there with an immigration sign calling us over, and they must not get many tourists, because we were tourist number one and tourist number two. And we did not have the necessary paperwork in order to get the permit to be on that island. We had to go to other offices. We went to this government office, and Peter Solomon kept trying to send in the preacher to come in and help us, and we kept telling him, "Go away," because we were thinking, "We're just ignorant tourists." And that usually is the best route when you're in situations like that. You're just an ignorant tourist, and just smile and lick your ice cream, and everything's good. But anyway, we did eventually get permission to be on the island. We were informed that it would be illegal for us to preach and teach, so Peter Solomon did all of the speaking there. But this is it's such an interesting island, because we hear of persecution in India. I've just never seen it. I've never seen it in the places I've gone to. We hear there's places that want nothing to do with the gospel, but now we saw it. Now we saw a world that still exists where you're not in a good light if you're a Christian. You're shamed by all the Hindus around you. You're shamed because of these Christian practices that you espouse. So it was just an interesting few days to spend there with them as the church is working. Titus, he's working hard, but it's very difficult. The church is growing slowly, but it's going to continue to grow very, very slowly. We were able to see one baptism while we were there. Of course, we saw a whole lot of needs, like we see everywhere. The church doesn't have a church building. Maybe it's even harder in a place like this. We listened to all of the needs, and it's hard for us. I know Jeff felt the same way, to hear a young father talking about his struggles. He's receiving maybe about $100 a month, and we hear of all the needs, and we're thinking, as hard as it is to say it, we finally told him, "We don't think Graymere could be effective in, because it's so remote, we don't think we could be effective in taking on responsibility for that work, because It's so remote that people are not, we're not going to be able to visit there. It's so unconducive to foreigners to get on the island. But we mentioned how Peter Solomon's been the one pushing this work for so long. He walked right through without drawing any attention to himself. He went around and preached as free as he wanted. And nothing negative was said about that. So we finally told him, let's talk to the Sinagar church and let them continue this work. Let's get them to step up. Church that plants a church that plants a church is our model. So we think this is an opportunity for them to do that. Now, we did help him to buy a motor scooter. They had no transportation. So we were able to, that was neat. I think that surprised him when he were going through this list of needs and we're thinking, we ought to do something. Let's help with one of the short-term needs. Let's go to the Honda dealership. And so I think that really surprised him when we took care of him in that way. What were you born for? What is it that you're known for? What is it that you place your hope in? A lot of us probably fall into the trap of placing our hope in the bank account, in the occupation, maybe in a good name or a good reputation. But the fact is that we all have that same debt that Paul had. We ought to feel that same indebtedness. Paul was reborn for this. He was reborn for this life where he was shamed for the gospel. But he was reborn for this life of sharing the good news of salvation with others. We've each been reborn for that purpose as well. I'm so thankful for this church. I'm thankful for what we get to do, for what you make possible. I'm thankful that there's individuals here that join with us in doing those things as well. But maybe there's an opportunity tonight for someone here who's not yet put Christ on in baptism. There's an opportunity for you to be buried with him, to be reborn for this life. And that's the invitation that's open tonight. If one would like to respond to the gospel, if one would just need prayers or help in any other way, we're here to do that. Won't you come right now as we stand and as we sing?